It is just us.
Any words of wisdom?
Be extremely subtle, even to the point of formlessness. Be extremely mysterious, even to the point of soundlessness.
Thereby you can be the director of your opponent's fate. I'm surprised the Kelpian, of all beings, has studied Sun Tzu.
I am surprised that Terran is surprised by anything.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, trying to have a little fun along the way.
And we're here this time to talk about Rediscovering Discovery Season 2, on Blu-ray.
On Blu-ray. I like that, Cam. Yeah, look, we did our season-ending review a couple months ago, right after the season had concluded. I think maybe we gave it a one-month break, but
yeah.
Now the Blu-rays are out. And instead of watching it week to week, Cam, we actually had the chance, the opportunity, the delight to binge-watch it in a very compressed period of time.
It was an experience that few will understand.
I've fallen behind on The Crown season 3 at this point, but nonetheless, cool experience. Before we kind of dive into our binge mode experience, I think a lot of people are going to be wondering, as we get to the holidays, is this going to be worth a purchase? Will my loved one who's a Discovery fan, will it be worth it for them to take the dive into the physical media versus just having it available on streaming? I think those are some very good questions to ask people right now.
Assuming, of course, they also already own the animated series, so you can't just buy them that, right?
Well, yeah, doubles would be good.
That's true.
The animated series. Yeah. So look, let's kick it off with maybe a little bit of technical stuff here. We were watching it week to week on, I think, cable television, and then we would usually watch the episode again on Crave TV, which is the Canadian streaming service. So we actually got to see it twice a week in multiple ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think we thought the effects, the VFX, looked much better than they did in season one, at least on the streaming and cable versions. We thought that the VFX looked outstanding on the season one Blu-ray version. I think, yet again, this is another step up when we see the Blu-ray, just how the VFX look on Blu-ray season two versus cable streaming season two. Just the compression, the video compression that you get from broadcast and streaming. I'm sorry, we're just kind of not quite up there yet.
Well, there was a lot of talk with The Mandalorian coming out recently, how they'd really blurred the line between cinema and TV when it came to like blockbuster style, you know, properties. And Discovery really did it again. When you watch like season two Discovery at home, it looks fantastic, especially when you're watching, you know, that huge finale.
Yeah, and I'll just brag a little bit, but just watching on my 65-inch 4K,
right,
it's like something to behold, especially when you kick it off with an episode like Brother, you know,
right?
Like that is just kind of an action-packed jaunt.
Meanwhile, I was watching on my like 10-inch kitchen black and white TV.
You're playing with the rabbit ears.
Yeah.
Got to get that Blu-ray signal. But beyond the kind of the technical stuff there, the special features.
Yeah.
They bragged on it. 4 hours of special features. Cam, we believe them. We watched all the special features.
Yes, we did.
Which was an interesting experience as well.
Well, this really does feel like more of an event than maybe we're underselling it a bit, because this is not something that really happens anymore. Special features kind of suck on almost every release that comes out of things that I really love. You know, I will go and buy the Blu-ray to support the property, you know, also because I'm a, like a pack rat with a collector's habit. So, you know, whatever the latest sequel or whatever franchise entries, I'll buy it. And the like special features for almost everything I love now are terrible. And they really went all out on this Discovery Blu-ray for giving you a lot for your money, which for a streaming TV show being given a secondary Blu-ray release, they did not have to do.
Yeah, for us Canadians, it was, what, about $50, give or take a few dollars with tax and everything like that? I did not feel like when I walked away after watching all of the special features that I got ripped off by any degree. Like I was quite satisfied with that. We don't need to like spoil special features. Even if we do, like people, they're worth watching. We can only describe them so much, but everything from just like delving into how the VFX are done on kind of a daily basis. I think it's Jason Zimmerman is a VFX supervisor, and he was talking about how he has a team of 10 that work in his office, but there's probably about 500 people worldwide contributing something to the VFX on the show. And it's just like amazing to think about just the scale of this series. And you mentioned how good the VFX are. Do you think it's because it's Star Trek? Like they kind of know that there is a market for it that maybe The Good Fight, also on CBS All Access, doesn't necessarily have for behind the scenes sort of stuff.
I wonder if it also has to do with the Kelvinverse movies, which really did raise the bar for, I mean, the amount of money being spent on Star Trek movies on the big screen, but also just pushing the special effects envelope that much further. And so how do you make a 2010s Star Trek series and then downgrade the visuals from the movies? It's a tough sell to try to grab people, I think.
Yeah, what do you think about the amount of special features with regards to this? Do you think it's they're documenting all of this just because they know that there's a market for it because of Star Trek?
It must be. There's no other reason to be doing this much extensive behind-the-scenes shooting with all your, you know, your crew members to put these packages together unless you know that there's a special audience that wants it.
Yeah, because, you know, there's other streaming services that do put things out on physical media.
Sure.
And I'm very skeptical that they're putting 4 hours of it out there. I also think that CBS is being very smart in that, like, they're going to want to have this footage available to them for the archives for years to come, for documentaries down the road. Hopefully some of those documentaries documenting all of the behind-the-scenes shenanigans going on in Discovery Season 2, which was not addressed at all whatsoever.
Yeah, that's something I'm not a big fan of with special features now. You know, the Star Wars movies have also done this a lot, where they would put out these hour-long special feature documentaries on, you know, say, like the first J.J. Abrams Force Awakens, and also on Rogue One. And we know there was huge behind-the-scenes issues going on there. You would not know that from any of the documentaries, which, why make it like hour-plus, you know, documentary and then gloss over all that? It seems weird to me.
Yeah, and look, in the past few years, we've been able to enjoy kind of warts and all documentaries on Deep Space Nine, TNG, Enterprise. The special features, they really delved into that on that Enterprise Blu-ray, did they not?
In shocking ways sometimes, where you would have like Brandon Braga dropping stuff where I was like, I can't believe this is on a major studio release now. And I mean, I'm very thankful for it. It was a great, great package.
But you know what I think the difference is between then and now is I noticed something in one of the special features. I think they were showcasing like a storyboard that they were doing, and it said on it, remember your NDA.
Which I did not see.
Your non-disclosure agreement, which means a lot of the people that are on these series, they just legally can't dish the dirt that might exist there. So I don't know if a warts and all look into Star Trek Discovery is really going to surface even like 2-3 decades from now. That's kind of the bummer, because I don't know, I'd love to hear more about the kind of tumult that's been affecting the series from its inception.
And yeah, I mean, I will say, to the benefit of Discovery with their special features, the stuff they do focus on is much more the craftsmanship of the elements of the show, which it doesn't feel like they're just kind of glossing over everything, being like, everything was great. They're at least shifting their focus to elements of things we will find interesting, not just kind of giving this, you know, smiling, happy faces throughout, being like, everything was great when we shot this, everything was great when we shot that. You know, they don't do that. They just go into depth on craftsmanship level stuff that NDAs are very, that stuff's all covered.
Yeah, exactly. And look, let's talk about it. Like, I love actually seeing how Gersha Phillips, the costume designer, was just like breaking down all the thought that's put into it.
Yeah, a lot that of was stuff, a great, great segment.
Yeah, just a lot of stuff that I wasn't even like thinking of as I was watching it at the time. Like, say how in all her Vulcan costumes, she was subconsciously putting V's into all of them. Like, that's really cool stuff. Just the way that they were thinking about kind of the way the Klingons looked this year versus the previous season. Just there's some very cool things that we don't need to spoil too much, but it's like, wow, these people really actually think far, far more deeply about everything going on than you would ever expect, which is great to see here.
Oh, for sure. And I thought it was really interesting. There's one special feature called The Red Angel, where they go in depth on building the Red Angel suit. And I thought that was really interesting, where it's the prop maker specialist working with Gersha Phillips, yeah, talking about putting this suit together. Although it is interesting off the top when they're talking about, we don't know if this is an alien or a suit. And I was like, that's interesting that they don't know that at this point in time. And then I'm like wondering, I'm having this thought experiment, like, is that because the production is keeping them in the dark? Or is that because they don't know yet? Like, I think what is going on here?
I think it's the former.
It seems odd, though, to give your design team an assignment without them quite knowing what the specifications of the assignment are.
I think that's pretty common, though, just because, for a movie, that would be weird because, you know, people would have the script in front of them. But for something where they're trying to keep everything so secret, like, give everything on, like, a need-to-know basis. So that doesn't shock me so much, you know. I also love the makeup special features that we got to see with Glenn Hetrick and Neville Page diving into just all the thought put into that. I had no idea that they were actually had like multiple designs for Vulcan ears that they were contemplating. Yeah. And it was just cool. And also to think of Doug Jones having to get that full body cast made of him, you know? You know, would you be signing up for a body cast of yourself at any price if it was for the sake of art, Cam?
Maybe. If I can have a replica that I can then use for pranks on people.
Okay.
That would be worth it to me.
Throwing it off a dam. I can play Tommy Lee Jones in that situation. Yeah. I think maybe my favorite one, and it wasn't one of the longest ones, though. It was actually about 10, 15 minutes. It was actually the building of the Enterprise Bridge.
Yeah.
And how there are long discussions about whether or not the production designers would actually even get to build the bridge. And
yeah.
They said it was a very last minute decision.
No kidding. That was really fascinating to me.
Yeah. You know, because I think, because, you know, there's another special feature that even dived into how the finale, which we got to see the bridge in,
yeah,
it was originally supposed to just be one episode.
Right.
And then they realized we've got too much stuff to wrap up. And that actually really made me appreciate how they're like, okay, well, we've got one more hour to deal with things. So what's the fun stuff that we can do with the characters? What, even those are, that's a very fast paced final hour of two-parter.
Big time.
There's a lot of great character stuff going on. And so I appreciate that. Like, I'm like, yeah, that's what Discovery is like, probably excels best at is when you have those slower character moments versus the fast paced go, go, go exposition dump.
Oh, totally. And now, what did you think of, like, the two, we get two big documentaries on the set. One is sort of an overview of the season, and the other is really about that finale and putting it all together.
Yeah.
So, what were your thoughts on these two?
I love the one about the finale.
Yeah, it was amazing.
It was, like, just captivating to see how even the producing director, Olatunde Osunsami, like, he was just, like, a pig in crap, like, just talking about his ability to delve into this world, create like one of the biggest action sequences in Star Trek period.
Yeah.
And just the freedom he was given. And I think it really seems as if he and Alex Kurtzman are on the same kind of level. They see eye to eye about kind of their visions for the storytelling that they want to accomplish there.
They had a great statement though about Olatunde there, where they said that he really goes for the emotion in all of his scenes, which is something when I heard that underlined in that documentary really did line up with my perspective on what Discovery is and why it is different than, say, the other Star Treks.
Yeah.
And that he is someone who's always trying to find the emotional truth in a lot of these scenes. Whereas when you go back to previous series, I don't think that was necessarily the way they approached the shows.
Not a Patrick Stewart-led stoic captain sort of.
No, they were just having much more of an intellectual approach to the storytelling,
yeah,
which worked incredibly well for the respective series. But I just think that this approach is a very interesting angle, because usually when we talk about a new Star Trek series and people, you know, are talking about a new movie or whatever, a new reboot, their approaches tend to be more of like, what's the visuals going to be like? What is this, you know, is it going to be bigger, more explosive? You know, they don't tend to go like, what is the emotional approach to the storytelling going to be? And I love that that's how Discovery really does feel different.
Yeah.
And it's something that I think we kind of take for granted a bit when there's so much flash going on with Discovery already.
But
that's its strength.
It's carving out its own identity. Because, do we really need to see kind of the same sort of storytelling patterns again and again and again? And it's like, hey, old school fans, you've got 750 hours of that. So go ahead, watch your old Blu-rays. Like, I'm happy to see Star Trek try to strike out, do something new. I wonder how that approach is going to be on Star Trek Picard.
There's no way they're taking the emotional approach there.
But you know what?
We'll see.
Star Trek Picard is going to feel different than TNG, and that's very, very purposeful. And I wonder the influence that Patrick Stewart's going to have on that series. I think there's going to be maybe kind of a mix of both approaches, though, moving forward. Look, the fact is, the last trailer that we saw, we literally see, you know, Will Riker putting his arm around, like, Jean-Luc.
Good point.
Is that a scene that you see in, like, season one of TNG?
Yes, except Riker is actually Q in disguise.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
And then he picks up his trombone and starts just blasting it.
That's right.
Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. So you mentioned the other big special feature,
mm-hmm.
which was like the season two overview.
Yeah.
Cam, I was bored out of my mind watching this. It was pretty much all the production crew. You would take it episode by episode and they would just describe what happened in every episode. And there was a couple interesting insights. Like I won't slam it for that. You know, there's stuff that I didn't know.
I've seen worse versions of this.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But I was pretty bored because I had literally just watched the series. I had literally just binged watched it. And now I had to spend 45 minutes listening to them summarize it all.
Plus a lot of clips of the show as well in there.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like, yeah, I know. I was just there.
And so for, you know, listeners that are wondering, do I need to watch all 4 hours of the special features? I'd skip that one. That's actually literally the only one that I would skip. And I'll be honest, I did skip Runaway, the short trek that was included on this disc. The only other short trek that was included was The Brightest Star. I actually made sure that I watched that right before The Sound of Thunder, the Saru-centric episode about Vrahi.
Yeah.
And I found that a helpful rewatch. I just did not feel compelled to, right before Such Sweet Sorrow is going to kick off with the biggest action we've ever seen. I didn't really need to see Tilly and Poe eat ice cream,
right.
So that was kind of my take there. So maybe I only watched 3 hours and 45 minutes worth of special features here.
Right.
So what was your take on the season two overview?
I think a lot of people, your more general fans, will probably enjoy this type of special feature. But for me, it just holds little to no value. It's something like I watch once and I go, okay, moving on to the next feature, and I'll never watch it ever again.
What was the point of it, though? Was it made for people that...
I think a lot of people just want to see the episodes they remember highlighted and then get, you know, Michelle Yeoh being like, we had a lot of fun shooting that part. And they're like, oh, cool. Next.
Yeah, but to me, I just like, I would have to justify it as a filmmaker. Like, what am I giving audiences here? And like, I got really nothing out of this.
And yet, sadly, it's better than most special features on Blu-rays
now.
Yeah,
no, no kidding.
So, I mean, it really does feel, though, when you say you get a Marvel movie and you watch those EPK quality documentaries on their sets, that's what it feels like an extended version of.
Yeah. Special feature I want to highlight here is when they're talking about the production, as in the production design of everything.
Oh, yeah.
That's just fascinating to watch, especially we get to be on Kronos, the whole new look of that. One thing we do have to pick on the production people just a little bit, the ones that are not like you and me, Cam, that have seen 750 hours of Star Trek.
Sure.
But the man that I was speaking so highly of just a second ago, Alatunde Onsasami, he did say how... this is the first time we've ever been inside a Klingon home in canon.
Yeah.
And as soon as he said that, I was like, well, what about House of Quark? What about Redemption Part 2? What about Birthright? You know, like we've been into... what about Worf on Deep Space Nine and the Defiant? You know, it's like we've seen Klingon homes many a time. Well, Worf on the Enterprise D, you know?
Right.
So I was just like, okay. I don't know where he got that statement from. And that kind of... It made me fold my arms like a pouty fan might, you know. So
yeah.
Do you remember in season one, they had like the previous showrunner, Aaron, I think it's Aaron Harberts. He was saying like, yes, Star Trek has never delved into war before.
Oh, yeah. I remember that famous quote. That was in the special features on season one, wasn't it?
Yeah. So it's just like fans kind of pounced on him for that as well. Which like, okay.
That was the least of his problems, it would seem, going forward.
Well, that's just it. We alluded to the kind of the you know, behind the scenes stuff that was problematic, but they fired the co-showrunners halfway through season two.
Right.
And you could kind of tell where that was. I think the first one without them was Light and Shadows, the one that we first discovered Spock. Because I was paying attention to the credits to see where Gretchen Berg and Aaron Harberts were no longer featured. So they got up to what was one right before that? Right before Light and Shadows. It would have been...
The Sound of Thunder.
Thank you, Cam.
You're welcome.
So yeah, just any final thoughts on special features before maybe we kind of give our thoughts on kind of what it's like to binge watch Discovery season 2 versus watching it week to week.
I think it's a really solid collection because, you know, even if you don't want the documentaries, they don't interest you. You get those short treks. You have a gag reel that was actually funny. Yes, I have sat through a lot of gag reels in my time, and most of them are eye rolling of just actors dancing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay.
There's a lot of actors just dancing.
It seems to be the case.
I also want to say this. Did you notice that my favorite gig in the gag reel was when Anson Mount said, Spock, come in. It's Spike.
Yes.
Yes. Because we've struggled so much with getting Spock, Spike, and Pike all mixed up and jumbled up in our mouths when we're doing the videos, we're doing the podcast here. We're not the only ones, Cam. It's literally professional actors have trouble with this bit of a tongue twister here.
Yeah, but there was actually genuinely funny stuff in the gag reel, so I was very thankful to that. But also, you've got commentaries on a few episodes, which is noteworthy as well nowadays.
Did you listen to any of them?
I listened to bits and pieces. I just didn't have time because we spent a lot of time submerging ourselves in this Blu-ray set for this episode. Yeah. I didn't have a lot of time, but I did listen to chunks of the Anson Mount Ethan Peck one.
I listened to the Jonathan Frakes Anson Mount one. That one's look. They recorded in two different rooms across North America. That's kind of a tough prospect. There wasn't a lot of fun back and forth. The two men like each other, get along, but it wasn't a Joss Whedon-esque sort of hilarious insight into the making of an episode. It's a lot of stuff like, what a beautiful actor.
Yeah.
What a great performer.
Yeah.
I'm just like, okay.
It really takes a type to do those commentaries. I think it's a lot harder than people might realize.
We've tried it before with Shades of Grey.
I did Shades of Grey alone, yeah.
Yeah, and then I think you and I did Threshold together.
And Yesterday's Enterprise.
Well, what we realized, though, is we figured out that we had to watch them first, take notes.
Yeah.
And then we had to sit down and do the recording together. Otherwise, it's really hard to just like kind of comment on like things as they appear on screen. Because a lot of these commentaries, it's literally just people describing what you're seeing on screen.
Right.
It's kind of like, really?
Yeah.
But you know, people don't do a lot of commentaries anymore. So the fact that we had, I think, what, 4 or 5 of them on this?
Yeah, like, 4, yeah.
Like, great deal for fans there.
Yeah, oh, totally. Like, that's the thing. This whole package is a really great deal. And we're not just, like, shilling this for the sake of shilling Star Trek. Like, genuinely, this is a really good Blu-ray set in a time where we don't get good Blu-ray sets.
Yeah. So, CBS, if you want to make it up to us, you can send us refunds for this stuff that we're promoting for you guys.
Sure. Or just send us a copy of Season 3 on Blu-ray.
Send it immediately.
Yeah.
So, overall, I think we would recommend fans, yes, buy this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're not going to go wrong with this. Binge mode, Cam.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was a different experience. And
it really was. And I prepared for it, Tyler. I don't know if people can tell listening to this from the podcast, but I've had the flu the last little bit. And so I decided, you know, what do the families of, you know, like the Spock family, the Sarek family do when they're not quite right? They read Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. So, Tyler, I read that before I went into my season 2 deep dive.
And what did you glean from it that would really shepherd?
Nothing. I just thought it'd be a funny anecdote for the podcast, really.
Okay.
I read it in 2 sittings. So
That's all right, you know. Based on the Sarek family, they read it every single night.
That's right, so yeah. I was just genuinely curious if it would give me something from a character standpoint that maybe I didn't pick up on. Not so much,
yeah.
But you know, I think they do a good job underlining why that particular story ties to Spock and his disabilities.
And there are like good moments brought from it, but it's just like this motif
has
been stretching back to season 1.
Big time.
I'm sick of it.
Yes.
It's like, okay, you've run it into the ground at this
point. Right.
But let's tackle it as a whole, because I think we were watching it week to week.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember week to week thinking like, huh, I wonder where this is going. I guess I'll have to tune in next week. And now that I watch it, I know where everything is going. I was a little less patient with certain aspects, certain storylines that were going on, because I ultimately knew where they were going and what they added up to. So it's more of a mixed bag actually watching in binge mode. Like I much preferred my week-to-week experience, just kind of like diving into it right away, thinking about what A could mean and B would have implications for later down the road, like that sort of stuff. Like there's more theorizing going on, wondering where characters were going to do and that sort of stuff. But here I was just like, okay, there's a whole lot of story to unpack. And yeah. We had like a week at a time to unpack everything. This, it'd pretty much like play an episode. You have about like 30 seconds until like the next one would start up. And then, so it's a different experience doing binge mode.
Yeah, it really was. And similar to, you know, when we did season one, we talked about how when we binged it, the Ash Tyler romance with Burnham felt a lot quicker than it did watching it week to week. We were like, how long do you expect me to care about this? And I felt similarly binging season two, the search for Spock element of the first six episodes didn't feel as grating to me as it did watching it at the time.
I was thinking of that exact same thing because I remember like every single week you and I are like, well, when is Spock going to show up now?
Yeah. And a lot of that, like there's his shuttle on the in the distance.
Yeah.
That stuff really did kind of gloss over in the binge version.
Yeah. I was very much placated seeing like a young Spock, in some of the episodes. We'd get a voiceover from one Ethan Peck in another episode. And then we finally saw him and it's like, okay, yeah, I get it. You know, like it didn't seem to take nearly as long. We weren't kept on pins and needles nearly as much.
No, it was actually like interesting because season two really did feel much more cohesive than season one did, where you had it broken up in kind of these chunks of episodes telling different kind of stories. This really did feel like one big story.
Mm-hmm.
And that often made it tougher to track episode to episode, especially when it came to ranking the episodes, which you'll do later in the show. But it was just very interesting to me how I feel like this was a really, really, like, almost great season of Star Trek for me. But, like, the problems are there. It's, like, manages to just glide over so many of the problems in terms of just keeping you, at least in the binging version, just keeping you going. Where I found it did drag down, though, would be, and this was a note I made at a certain point, probably, like, maybe five or six episodes in, where there was a lot of characters talking about the status quo. Where are we right now? What's happened the last, couple episodes? And I feel like in a world of binging TV and serialized TV, that sort of thing is really annoying.
It's very clumsy exposition.
Yes.
Somewhat related to that, but a little bit different, though. Like, one of the biggest eye-roll-inducing scenes for me was when they landed on that Section 31 pile of bodies and they beamed over Comron Gantz.
Yeah.
And then they had a flashback to this no-name character on the bridge of the Shenzhou. And then they flashed back to him on their shuttle pod. And I was like, no one's going to care about this flashback to some no-name. It was just so clumsy. And it's not the kind of stuff you do in like prestige television.
Right.
And the thing is that they keep marketing this as, oh, it's prestige TV. I'll say this. I'm going to walk away from season two. And I'll be honest. Like, I think the show's had 2 years to kind of find its grounding.
Yep.
We have Michelle Paradise and Alex Kurtzman. They're co-showrunners. They seem like pretty solid in their roles going into season three. I'm going to have much less patience with the show and its faults in season three than I think I did. I think I was pretty easy on it going into season two and season one as well. So.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it started off very strong, though, with Brother and New Eden. And I think the momentum of those two episodes back to back.
Yeah.
I gave it a lot of leeway going in. But there's like other stuff. I realized like, wow, they talk about time crystals and sphere data a lot.
Yes,
and
they do.
It's like MacGuffin. I'm just kind of, it's like, that's not the stuff that I ever cared about when I was watching the show.
It's such a character-rich show, though. Like, that's the thing. I walk away going, like, that's what carries me through this entire second season is they amp up the character moments so much that it's like the sort of the details of the plotting I can almost push into the background.
I know.
But I didn't necessarily on this viewing. I actually sat there with charts tracking things, and I want to get into some of that stuff a little bit later. But just in terms of like a sweeping epic, 14 episodes of television, it really does, season two, I feel, really carry you through it in a way season one didn't.
Well, so I went back and I listened to our initial season two review.
Yeah.
And it was interesting how some of the issues that I had with it on the initial week to week didn't really matter to me so much on the binge mode. Tilly's arc, for example.
Yeah.
I remember you and I were discussing how she just seemed to have absolutely no arc, no momentum after everything went down with May, the fungal parasite.
Right.
I thought that was a really, really lame character arc. And then I realized, you know what? Tilly was actually adding quite a lot just in those great, great character moments. Not necessarily with momentum of a story or plot, but that's not ever been Discovery's strength. Plot is definitely not Discovery's strength at all.
Yeah.
But Tilly had, I think, even like better character moments throughout all this season than she did in season one, you know? And we've really seen this character come a long way from where we started off with her, you know, like 30 episodes ago.
Yeah, and I really can't wait to see where that character ends when the series reaches whatever, you know, final season it has. Because I do feel like that'll be the character that may change among the most of any character we've seen, maybe in the history of Star Trek.
Yeah.
You know, there's some big ones out there, like, you know, we talked about Nog not too long ago, but I think Tilly could be a really interesting to see where that character tracks, you know, but over like 5 or 6 seasons.
The other thing that I did not find as frustrating during this watch was the Stamets-Culber stuff.
Yeah, same.
You and I think we found that arc very unpleasant because it's two characters that we like.
Yeah.
Just kind of fighting with each other. And it just doesn't make for good television. But this, it kind of, like you said earlier, it kind of glided through this a lot quicker than I remember it when it was like week to week. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I hope these two kids are still together. You know, Culber has found his family going into season 3, apparently.
Right.
Yeah, but it was just, but still, like, that episode, Saints of Imperfection.
Yeah.
It was like a flaming dumpster fire of an episode right there.
Tyler, let's track the journey that brought Culber back to us.
Oh, God.
Because this is where it gets really interesting to me.
Okay.
We get Culber dies in season 1, right? Now, it's Stamets' kiss that transfers, like, spore energy to his body.
I thought it was his teardrops.
Or his teardrops, either one.
Yeah.
Whatever it was.
His teardrops, for sure.
Okay. transfers it to Culber. Now, this somehow sends him into the spore drive, correct?
No, I don't think that's correct.
Well, it's like your energy. It transfers his energy into the spore, like into that world, into the mycelial network. Mycelial network.
I think the way that he phrases it, transferred his essence, into the mycelial network.
Right. Yeah. Now, then the beings of the mycelial network built him a body. When he's there.
I think so.
Yes. Or, that is what they said.
Did the beans build him a body, or did a body manifest because his essence had been transferred into the mycelial network?
And now May actually says we built him a body.
Okay, the fact that you and I have both gotten like pertinent details wrong so far just shows you how confusing
this is. Oh, I was taking notes on this one. And then this body could not be absorbed into the mycelial network.
Okay.
Because he found the yi trees or whatever they're called.
Yeah, there was bark. I remember there was like poisonous bark.
So then he covered himself in the poisonous bark of these trees. Then they became convinced that he was a monster and was going to destroy their network. But then fortunately, Tilly had become infected with this, you know, had found this sample of dark matter.
Well, yeah.
Right? In the asteroid. That had then allowed May to come into Tilly's presence as this...
is because May had originally, back in season 1, fallen into her hair?
Shoulder hair, yeah, one or the other. Yes.
And then the black matter triggered the manifestation of May in front of Tilly.
Correct.
Okay.
And then they separate the two of them through that Ghostbusters device, which then leads to this cocoon creature, which is a transporter into the mycelial network, correct?
I'm following you.
And then May is going to take Tilly into the mycelial network through this transporter, where to help solve the problem of the monster.
Yeah.
Well, it's tough to get Culber back out of there, but they use said transporter once again to get him out.
To reconstitute his matter in this universe.
Correct. And he comes back with a shave and a good haircut.
But he's a shaken man. He doesn't have the scars that he used to have because he's completely reconstituted. He doesn't feel like the same man.
Now, this journey on a writer's board, this is quite a journey for Culber, Tyler. Like, does this make any... When you really break this down, this gets really, really, really convoluted.
Cam, I said earlier, like, plot is not Discovery's strength.
Yeah.
And, like, the fact is, like, I think we were watching it week to week going like, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. But honestly, if you break it down like that, it doesn't sound like sci-fi. It sounds like magic.
Yeah, and it sounds like a lot of backpedaling on the point of view of the writers trying to fit pieces together.
And the reason why is like the writers faced a lot of backlash because you've got like a gay character. Star Trek really isn't known for its LGBTQ representation. So you've got like a fan favorite gay character that they kill off in a really stupid way.
Yeah.
After what, like 7-8 episodes? And I think the worst thing that they could have done was instead of just owning it, you know, I don't think it was a good creative decision, but instead of just owning it, they're completely backpedaled on everything, which turned into this very convoluted mess. I just, like, the whole thing, as much as I like Culber, like, it just, I walk away thinking this is, like, the worst kind of plot arc that we have so far in Discovery.
Yeah, it's interesting when I was going through Discovery, both seasons one and two, there would be points where I would find myself trying to break down the details of the overarching story that was being told to me, because it was like, I get what they're telling me, but the pieces aren't lining up in my head. And I'm not generally a person who obsesses over these sorts of things when I watch movies or TV.
Neither am I.
I'm not someone who tends to be also confused when I'm sitting down talking about a piece of media, conveying back the story. You know, and that goes for like 750 hours of previous Star Trek, or however many hours there are. Like, yeah. I don't sit through previous Star Trek episodes going, what's going on? Like, I can't quite pin that one down. I'll rewatch the episode and be like, oh, cool. It's all there right there. It makes sense to me. I had to sit there with like a pen making notes. I had a whole separate like charting the Culber arc to try to make sense of it. And I did a similar one with the Red Angel arc. That one makes more sense, but it's still a lot of like, wait, okay, hold on. This has to happen there. This has to, and you know, how does this tie into Control? Okay, it's coming through the similar black holes. Like, it gets very convoluted in a way where I think it does a disservice to the show, because it makes it look haphazard storytelling as opposed to an organic arc.
Speaking of organic, the organic sphere data, that was mm-hmm. another thing, and also just how it related to Control, the yeah. AI being, and one of the things that we found out in the special features is that the organic sphere, it was actually just kind of a one-off, meant to be a one-off sort of like bottle episode sort of deal. So then they realized, oh, we've got something interesting here. So then they keep dropping how important sphere data is for the AI Control and the journey through time. You have to get time crystals.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, what? Am I playing Dungeons and Dragons right now?
Right.
Like, and like, I'm the same as you. Like, I don't obsess over like plot stuff. For me, it's really like, it doesn't matter so much as like what the characters are saying, so much as you understand kind of the emotion in the scene, what the thrust of it all is. But when I have Tig Notaro just belching out like nonsensical exposition about the cage, is the cage big enough? Does the cage need to be expanded? What happens to the cage?
Right.
And I'm just like, what are you even talking about? Like, it just, I don't get any sort of emotional connection out of this. And when you watch it all through binge mode, you have even less time to let it all kind of sink in, try to justify it in your own brain. I sat through this binge just looking forward to all the character moments. Like, none of the plot stuff really mattered to me at all, really.
Yeah.
In as much as like we would get to have the plot bring us to Talos 4 or something right. like that. Like, that would be cool stuff.
And that's where the show really excelled, was in that the individual episodes, to me, when I really did break them down, there's a heck of a lot of strong episodes in season 2 Discovery where the story that's being told in that specific episode really did grab me, and all the character stuff really worked. It was just really the overall arc stuff, asking me to sit there and look at the bigger picture, where I really began to have issues.
Yeah, and my concern going into season 3, though, is I think they still want to do a long arc. I think it would work much better, and this is something you've been floating ever since Discovery premiered, it'd be much better if they just did maybe 3-4 episode arcs. I go back to the Enterprise season 4 model. You know, I like the setting of Discovery, you know, flung about 1,000 years into the future going into season 3. I like that as a premise. Now let's work with like kind of like mini arcs within like your 13 episode season order. Like, I'm down for that. But like this very long arc where we're trying to track things, and the fact is that you and I are just really confused and baffled and like criticizing how convoluted a lot of the story stuff is, like that's not a nod of approval towards some of these creative decisions here.
Yeah. And I mean, we're actually trying to track all this stuff. A lot of people aren't.
No, I think a lot of people are probably maybe doing the second screen thing, or maybe folding sure. some laundry, or I don't know, but or just watching it for the character moments.
And some of the action sequences and the visuals, like a lot of the exciting yeah. stuff that a more casual TV viewer who's checking out, hey, what's this Star Trek show, might experience the show in that way. And that's fine. And I think the show actually works that audience really well, and that it does things are always happening on Discovery. You know, Alex Kurtzman has famously said it's like a bullet. And yeah, there's a lot of action. There's a lot of amazing character moments. The dynamics really work. So like someone who's maybe doesn't really care that much about the overall season arc, it doesn't matter. Like, you can really get pulled into the story through the relationships between the characters so well.
What I wonder, though, is, and I think I've floated this theory before, though, as well. It's like, you've got CBS investing just buckets and buckets of money into this. And when it comes to network notes, I think Netflix is known to be fairly hands-off. It depends on the series. You know, HBO gives a lot of leeway to the creators. What CBS is doing right now, it's a very new thing for them, in what you're trying to create all this prestige drama on a streaming service that doesn't have the same parameters as you would on network broadcast television.
Right.
I think what happens, though, is you have a lot of these CBS, you know, executives handing back notes, and I don't think they're handing back notes that say, oh, well, I have some thoughts about how you can make this character moment even better. I think what they're saying is like, well, what about the plot? What about the plot? I think all these guys, and I'm not trying to disparage like the suits, but I think what really they're all qualified for is like plot, plot, plot. Focus on plot.
Right.
And that, I don't know, like, did you find the plot very enthralling? Like the Red Angel mystery? Like, I didn't care. Like, they never explained why the Red Angel mystery was of interest to us. They never explained why Starfleet was so curious about it. It eventually became apparent that it was, that there were stakes to this, but I don't know why. It's a lot to ask as a viewer week to week watching this to be invested in this, where I think it's actually easier for us to watch it binge mode,
mm-hmm.
you know, with regards to the Red Angel. But I don't know. It was frustrating. As much as I love the show and the characters, it's just the plot stuff, it just felt as if we kept getting like dragged down, kind of like throwing a tennis ball against curtains a lot of the time, and that was the plot.
Right, and I mean, the arc of the season really is like this Red Angel story. I mean, I think it gave us, the actual arc of the Red Angel stuff gave us at least enough character moments tied to the Red Angel story so that it actually does have some meaning to me when it all ends. But to actually track it from a like plot point of view, episode to episode, is not particularly interesting, especially when you have episodes where characters are, okay, so what's going on with the Red Angel right now?
I know.
Okay, so we've had two signals over here, you know, one there, blah, 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 blah. And you're like, I don't care. Like, I just watched that episode.
And didn't I just see it in the previously on Star Trek Discovery?
Yeah.
It's like you're really beating over
I wish they'd hacked those out of the episodes on the Blu-rays.
I know. Yeah. And they don't often include them automatically for other, you know, physical media. Like, I'm thinking about my Mad Men Blu-rays or my Breaking Bad Blu-rays. I think they don't start with them.
There's like a 2.5 minute one at the start of the first episode on Brother for the previous season.
Yeah.
And I was like, is this necessary?
So, okay, so the Red Angel thing, here's my other big critique of Discovery Season 2. And I think for the most part, we've been praising the show. Like, we love the characters. You know,
this season does carry you on a journey.
It really does.
It's when you break it down the points of the plot that get really wonky, but like, it carries you on this, just this wave of like good vibes from the characters and a lot of fun.
Well, we'll get into it on the our rankings. But I have to say, where they leave you off in the finale.
Yeah.
That is one damn good finale.
It's an amazing, amazing episode of television. Like, I am so in love with that finale.
Yeah.
And it feels like it actually pays off. Like, it is like the big emotional crescendo to every episode that preceded it. So it actually does feel like the series took you on a journey in a way that season one didn't.
Well, I think that the fact that it's able to make the episodes that came before it appreciate and value.
Yeah.
I think that is a testament to what a strong finale it is, you know, and it's not necessarily every single Star Trek finale does that. Like, does Best of Both Worlds make, I don't know, the Survivors from season 3 a stronger episode?
Yes, it does.
Okay. you just want to dance with old people.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I just had one question though that I couldn't wrap my head around. Maybe you can answer. Maybe it's a really obvious answer, but who relocated the people of New Eden? Because they have the Red Angel on the stained glass, and I can't figure that part out.
All right, I thought it was Dr. Gabriel Burnham.
Okay.
He definitely was not Michael. But no. Didn't Dr. Burnham say she didn't do it?
Yeah, like she was tied to Burnham. Like, that's the thing. All the experiences she had were tied to Michael, like helping Michael in some way. And this was done during like World War III.
Yeah, so do you know, it could be though, maybe Michael just hasn't done it yet.
Maybe.
You know?
That was one of those lingering questions where I was like, maybe there's something there. Because they also reference her father could possibly be a question mark as well in the future.
Yeah.
So there's things like that. I said, okay, I guess that's just maybe going to come in the future.
One of the other things I thought was interesting is Lorca is kind of a patronly figure to her in season one.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Gabriel. And then her mother's name is Gabrielle, which I just thought was...
Oh, I didn't even put those two together. That's interesting.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. But while we're on this Red Angel discussion here, I'll lay my cards on the table. My favorite part about Star Trek Discovery is kind of the character stuff. But yeah. There were some brutal character moments. Remember when Leland explains to Michael Burnham his involvement with her parents' death?
Yeah.
And then she... clenches her fists together
yeah.
and punches him and says, that was for my mom.
Yeah.
And punches him again and that was for my dad. That was a horrible, horrible scene. Like, I was just cringing at how bad it was. And I was thinking about it. And I think one Nana visitor as Major Kira could totally pull that off.
Sure.
I don't think this is playing to SMG's strengths.
Right. Michelle Yeoh might have been able to as well.
She might have been able to, but that dialogue, that was bad dialogue. Yeah. And I'll say this. I think in season one, the writers played and the directors played more to SMG's strengths as a performer. I think the aloof Burnham, the one still kind of emulating that Vulcan lifestyle, I like that. You know,
right.
It was like a character we hadn't seen before. And one of the critiques during our season two review from a few months ago that's our guest at the time, David Boris, brought up, though, is it just seemed as if Burnham was crying every other episode.
Right.
And when you have that kind of person come out of their emotional cocoon, if the person is getting that emotional, like almost every single episode about every single thing. And again, I am a male commenting on how a woman is expressing her emotions. I am totally self-aware of that. And that's people come in all forms of how they express themselves. But it from a dramatic perspective, it loses its punch.
Right. Well, because you don't have that moment where it happens, where suddenly you're really like wowed or brought into the moment in a big way. If you repeat that over and over again, you kind of lose the impact of it.
Well, why do you think that, yeah. Picard and Chain of Command was
sure.
such a gut-wrenching thing to see? Is that we've never seen Picard broken down like that, you know?
Right.
But, you know, if we saw, you know, SMG in that kind of similar situation, we're like, oh, yeah, we see that almost every week. And I think it was playing to her strengths to have her as more of kind of the aloof, you know, Vulcan-esque sort of character as opposed to the where's my heart on my sleeve sort of character, though. I think we got a better performance out of her in season one. And my sense, though, is like the characters that we saw in season two, they're actually maybe the writers dialing in the writing more towards to how these performers are in real life.
I was thinking that as well, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Because if you ever see SMG, she seems like one of the nicest people in
absolutely,
the world.
Absolutely,
yeah. Like, I did a photo op with her. Like, just like, it's like a ball of joy.
Yes.
And, you know, when she does her panels, same thing. And you get the sense that the writers would write to the actor as they get to know them as well. And that
yeah.
happens with any captain or any character on Star Trek you go through. You know, they're very much writing to, Shatner at a specific point as well, or Nimoy, what have you.
Avery Brooks in The Pale Moonlight.
Big time,
That's Avery Brooks.
And I just wonder if they started to write to a character that they thought maybe in their from their perspective, she would be the best at maybe tackling. And maybe they felt that the handling of Burnham was a little rocky in season one. A lot of other things were.
Yeah.
So maybe they felt like this was the track to take. I think it sometimes works beautifully well. Like, I think some of her emotional moments with Spock are the highlights of the season.
But the other thing that we were never fans of were the Tyler Burnham romance, but in their departure from each other in Such Sweet Sorrow Part 1,
yeah,
it actually worked for us.
Yeah.
Though, and that was a very emotional moment. But the Spock Burnham moment at the very end of the finale, that has to be like the emotional highlight of the entire season. Like, that is just a fantastic moment. And that's SMG, I think, tapping into like that emotional side. And I think she did well at it. And it's just, I think it would have had that much more power to it if she hadn't gone to that well so frequently throughout the season.
Right.
Know? Like, you can tell I feel a little conflicted about like my critique of her because I like the character of Burnham so much. But I was a bigger fan of the character in season one than I was in season two, you
right.
know? So, I don't know. Maybe a few other critiques. Way too many reaction shots from, like, the bridge crew every time something happened on screen.
I would argue with that more if I didn't like them all so much.
It's just, like, every time something happened, you had to pan to every single, like, person on the bridge who would give, like, pretty much shruggy shoulders or something like that. It took me out of the moment, like, too often, though. Mm-hmm. But I did like the fact that we actually had, like, the bridge crew become more and more, like, part of the ensemble. Arium gets her own, like, kind of showcase period that. We get moments like Owashikan, like, getting to go down to New Eden. We find out that she's from a Luddite colony.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, like, those crazy things that
I think a lot of that stems from the Premier Brother, where you have Pike on the bridge doing the roll call through all the various crew members. And then he immediately goes into addressing them all by name because he's remembered it instantly. And that really does kind of sum up where the season goes from this point forward. They all matter. Like, their ranks don't matter. It's each member of that bridge crew is important.
But it's also like a moment that took me a second watch to realize. Remember he said, yeah, your ranks don't matter, just give me your names?
Yeah.
Gets to Arium, Lieutenant Commander Arium. Yeah. Which, like, that made me laugh on second viewing as well. So, the Pike Spock number one stuff, you know. We all want it, Cam. We all want that spinoff, and I just think that this reemphasizes it. Like, seeing them all on the bridge together at the very end of Such Sweet Sorrow Part 2, like, that is kind of a journey and adventure that we'd like to see continue.
Yeah, I mean, Anson Mount and Ethan Peck were just, I mean, they were up there with the MVPs for the season. Throughout, we've talked so much about how good Anson Mount was and Ethan Peck were, so we don't need to go into it ad nauseum again here, but, like, they were both absolutely incredible and contributed so much to the energy of the show. But I feel like Rebecca Romijn, in these short treks that have come out since, has really nailed down that character in a way that they didn't quite in the season. So yeah, I just want to see that play out more, because I feel like now they feel more solidified as a, like, threesome than they did when you get to this finale, for example.
Yeah, for sure. I'm with you there. I guess, lastly, we haven't really touched on Saru. But yeah. I think we found Saru a very frustrating character in season one.
Because he was so promising. That's what made him frustrating, was that you could see the greatness in that character, but the show was almost holding back on it.
But they gave him so much. I think he's just in it more consistently. Like, we would see Saru fall into the shadows for, like, weeks on end in season one, but he is very consistently showcased throughout this. He's got a very distinct arc. I think it gives more room for drama moving forward as well.
Yeah.
Especially when we have the captain question going on. My favorite part of other favorite part of the gag reel was when we have Anson Mount saying, "Now there's the question of the captain."
Right.
And then he turns around and he's like, "Squid face, you're going to be the new captain, Squid face."
Yeah.
And then, like, the person in the squid costume starts dancing.
Right. Like, that was great.
That was a great moment there.
Yeah. That was supposed to be in the show, though.
Deleted scene. Yeah. Okay. They wanted to leave some mystery going into season three.
That's right.
Okay. Well, spoiler. Sorry, guys.
Yeah. I actually really loved, too, what they did with Georgiou this season. And they did take a character who I thought was a questionable decision to bring into the larger storytelling at the end of season one, and actually made it a character that was really fun, contributed things to the show that the other characters simply couldn't, but you could get the sense of, like, where this character might go dramatically in a longer version, you know, when we get to the, you know, near the end of Discovery.
And I was actually trying to track where I turned on her, turned for the good on her, because you guys all heard me complaining, like, I don't want this sociopath character that I have to follow and cheer for as she, blah, blah, blah. When we get to If Memory Serves, that's where she starts doing her, like, patented one-liners.
Right.
Like, she's telling the crew, and hurry up, I don't have time for this. You know, like, while she's doing the holographic transmission to them, you know, giving them orders via Section 31. Like, they make her arch. They make her funny.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, good, you figured out the character finally, and I am totally down to see, like, way more Georgiou action going into season three.
And that's around the point, too, where Michelle Paradise has taken over as a showrunner, and it does feel like a lot of the character stuff gets amped up around the point she enters as, like, the co-showrunner with Alex Kurtzman.
Yeah.
Like, it really does feel like the show focuses its stories more. Like, I like some of the earlier half of the season. Like, there's some episodes on there that are going to rank higher on my, you know, rankings of the season. But when I would watch those episodes, I would see how, well, boy, this one's, like, split in four. We got four stories going on at the same time. Maybe one of these isn't that interesting.
Yeah.
Whereas when you get further down the road, they feel far more focused episode to episode.
All right, well, it'll be interesting when we do our rankings. And before we do that, Cam, I have a bit of a surprise segment that I want to introduce to you.
Ash Tyler's greatest moments?
I just call them Tyler's greatest moments, and I'm talking about myself right here.
Right.
Do you recall maybe 2 or 3 years ago, we had a little thing called the Ortonville Report?
Of course.
Yeah. I did reviews, mini reviews, season one of The Orville before I gave up on that show. It just wasn't meant for me. I totally understand why people like it, though. I've got something new. I like to call it the Mandalorian Report.
Okay.
Remember last week I did give some brief thoughts on the first two episodes of Disney Plus's The Mandalorian?
Yeah.
And I realized, okay, you haven't been able to, you've been too busy watching Star Trek Discovery. You haven't gotten around to The Mandalorian.
I will start it probably, maybe tonight even.
Okay, okay. I won't spoil anything because I realize that people are also probably still catching up, getting on it. But I'll say this, episode 3. So I remember last week I said, I found it very pleasant. Episodes 1 and 2 of The Mandalorian, very pleasant show. I'm down with the show now. It's just like they just ramped it up in episode 3 where I'm like, oh, this is now must-see TV.
Right.
I'm sure you've been spoiled by, and look, if anybody's missed the Baby Yoda memes at this point, you're living under a rock. So, but like the following Mandalorian and Baby Yoda, that's been a fun journey. And the action, you feel the stakes very much. And I was listening to another podcast and then pointed out that like maybe the genius of it is you're in the Star Wars universe and it's almost kind of a low pressure sort of situation, though. Not just in like the adventures that they go on week to week, but the approach that the creators are having with the show in that it's not super, super self-serious. And I think that my one other critique of Star Trek Discovery, though, it takes itself very, very, very seriously.
Yeah.
It's like the writers are saying, we are a very important show. But I think you and I both agree, like, their best moments are, like, when they're not taking themselves so seriously. And yeah. I look at the short treks. You look at, you know, the Tribble episode or the Harry Mudd episode. You know, you're being reverential towards the series. You're playing around with it, but it's kind of more low-pressure stakes. And I think that's really where Mandalorian is excelling right now.
Right.
I hope, you know, my guess is that maybe Star Trek Lower Decks, the animated series, is going to be able to play within that kind of same playground. And
right.
So I just hope maybe Discovery Season 3, it can lighten up a little bit because I think they know that those lighter moments are their strength. So.
And maybe drop the whole, the end of all sentient life as we know it.
Every stories. Single season, because that's the problem. It's just like, yeah. If every season is the end of the universe, then it's like, okay, well, my suspicion is the crew will succeed somehow.
Right.
So, but why don't we mosey on back to our, you know, season one rank or season two episode rankings, and then we can just talk about our season three hopes and dreams and all that. Do you want to sure. kick it off? Do we want to go bottom to top or top to bottom? What do you think would work?
Why don't we go bottom to top? I think that probably makes the most sense.
Okay, you start off, sir.
Okay, so at number 14, I have Saints of Imperfection, an episode that I felt like really embodied all the things Discovery does the worst.
Yes.
At number 13, I had Point of Light, which is the Klingon story. There's another episode of Light in there, so I don't want to confuse anyone. This one, I like a lot of what it's doing. I just don't really like the final package.
Yeah.
And some of the side stuff is not that interesting. At number 12, an episode that fell a lot for me on my rewatch, which was Sounds of Thunder. I like a lot of the, you know, reintroduction of Saru's sister and everything. But I don't know. To me, this felt wrapped up so quickly. So quickly.
You just wanted more Ba'ul action.
The Ba'ul, could they be any more nightmarish? Yeah. Number 11, Light and Shadows. This is the reintroduction of Spock. It's kind of one of those in-between episodes. Number 10, Through the Valley of Shadows. Amazing Pike stuff. The other half
that was the only thing that was good, though, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All the Section 31 ship stuff was kind of like, okay, whatever.
Oh, hey, Cam, Gant's back. Remember
yeah.
Gant?
Yeah. That's an episode I actually thought would be amazing when I went back, and then it was like, oh, yeah, that stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, at number 9, I had The Red Angel. At number 8, I had Perpetual Infinity, which kind of pays off everything that's interesting in The Red Angel. Number 7, I had Brother, but I tell you, that whole scene of all the probes going through the asteroid field does nothing for me whatsoever. I found it even more trying to sit through again.
It's hard to track.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Number 6, I had New Eden, which is a really great, like, original series type episode in the Discovery universe. Number 5, Such Sweet Sorrow, Part 1, which you get all the amazing goodbyes in. Number four, Obel for Charon. I think that might be a little controversial. I think a lot of people would put that lower if IMDb is to be trusted.
I don't trust IMDb. Because guess what? It leans towards the people that feel compelled to go and rate things on IMDb. So that's why I can kind of only shrug.
Yeah. But
guys, Shawshank Redemption is not the best movie ever made, but IMDb would say that based on its ratings.
Yeah, it's the second after Star Trek Insurrection. at number three, I had Project Daedalus, an episode that jumped quite a bit for me, actually, on my rewatch. Number two, If Memory Serves. And then number one, I almost feel like is a cheat. And it's Such Sweet Sorrow Part 2. This is an episode that only works because of the journey you've gone on to get there, but it's so incredible.
I also wonder, though, if somebody just popped this in, never saw Discovery before, I think they might feel compelled to go catch up. I just think there's so much stuff that even if you don't understand the plot mechanics, you're there for the emotional journey. And like the last 5 minutes when you're just following kind of the wrap-up of Spock's journey, his future, it's like, and just the musical cue when they combine both the Discovery theme with the original Alexander Courage theme. And it's just the most beautiful musical cue that I've heard in Discovery so far. Like that final moment. You know, it's like both season finales so far end with the Enterprise.
Yeah, no kidding.
I wonder what season three is going to... Maybe it's going to be the wreckage of the Enterprise. We'll see.
Maybe.
Maybe they'll go to that planet Genesis and dig it up from the atmosphere or something.
I did struggle though, because If Memory Serves, which is the, you know, Talos 4 episode, was, I thought, like an incredible hour of television. And in a lot of ways, maybe it's the better written episode of the season, but I just had to give it to Such Sweet Sorrow Part 2.
Okay. Well, Cam, I will do my ratings.
I'm very curious to see how they line up.
Well, no, it was fun for me to actually listen to yours because there are some similarities and some differences here. But number 14, Saints of Imperfection. Number 13, Point of Light. Number 12, Light and Shadows. Number 11, Red Angel. Number 10, Perpetual Infinity. Number 9, Through the Valley of Shadows. Number 8, The Sound of Thunder. Number 7, Project Daedalus, much lower than you have it.
Yeah.
Number 6, Brother. Number 5, An Obel for Charon. Number 4, Such Sweet Sorrow Part 1. I really love kind of the slower character moments in that one.
Me too.
Especially when you know you're going to be jumping forward to just like the high action in the next one. It really works for me on second viewing. Number 3, New Eden. Old school Trek, Cam. Yeah. I love it. One, like, even after rewatch, this one still sticks with me. Like, they're really making Pike the best character captain that you could have. You know?
I think this episode might have been like near the top for me if they'd spent more time on New Eden.
Sure, sure. Number 2, If Memory Serves. And number 1, Such Sweet Sorrow Part 2.
Oh, interesting.
So I think we're probably more similar than we are apart.
Yeah,
on a lot
I guess
of
we
these,
had
though.
More of a disagreement on Sounds of Thunder was really the one that was the big outlier.
I did find that one more frustrating to watch on second, or I keep saying second viewing, but I guess it's really technically my third or fourth at this point.
Right.
But, I actually did find it more frustrating to watch on this watch than I remember when it initially came on. Like, I remember liking a lot of the, you know, Saru moments, but there's other stuff just going on with Section 31.
Yeah.
And I was just like, what? Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Season 3. We know the premise. The Federation seems to be a shell of its former self. I'm guessing we're going to see Discovery kind of remind the universe as we know it, what the Federation principles are.
Right.
Maybe see a rehabilitation of the Federation. I think this is kind of a great premise for the series. I finally feel as if I can summarize what the series is about in half a sentence, which is ship lost in the future.
Yeah.
I've never been able to do that with Star Trek Discovery.
No.
Like, how would you summarize the premise of season 2?
Well, I guess you would just tie it to the Red Angel stuff, but...
How would you summarize that in half a sentence to somebody that's never seen an episode with a Red Angel or anything?
A mysterious being is planting signals throughout the galaxy, and Discovery has to find out why.
Star Trek Deep Space Nine takes place on a space station.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, think about how many words you had to use versus how many words I had to use. So,
yeah.
Voyager. Ship stuck on the other side of the galaxy.
Right.
Yeah, it's just like kind of like, okay.
Yeah.
So now I'm down. Ship lost in time. I'm so down with Star Trek Discovery Season 3.
Ship or sentient ship? Because we could see some interesting things, because the Spore Data is still interacting with the ship when they're opening fire on Discovery to try and blow it up.
Or the Sphere Data.
Sorry, the sphere data, I should say. What did I say?
Spore data.
Spore data. Yeah, yeah, sphere data. No, I wonder why I would ever keep saying spore on the show Discovery.
It's still very unclear to me whether or not they are allowed to use the spore drive.
Yeah, who knows? But yeah, no, the sphere data was like not allowing them to open fire on Discovery. We've seen that short track Calypso where the ship is seemingly sentient. So I am curious what that sphere data, how that impacts the ship going into, you know, season three and onwards.
It's going to be a character in and of itself.
Yeah, it could be.
That'll be fun.
Yeah, I'm actually really looking forward to that. And
maybe that's the new captain.
That would be amazing. Yeah. Is the ship. Though I guess, you know, a lot of what we're being teased right now is that they're going to the future and the Federation is in dire, you know, straits, and Discovery will have to maybe help recreate the Federation. I don't know that that as a hook is that interesting to me. I just care more about where the characters are going, what new civilizations they're going to find. And Jonathan Frakes has been out there, you know, kind of in the press saying like, this is really going to be much more of the more fun, optimistic Star Trek that we all know and love. So I'm just curious to see what that means with the Discovery universe, because it has its own unique feel. So I want to see what more of that classic Star Trek feel is. And I'm kind of happy that we can kind of put a lot of the heavy stuff in the background for now. You know, we've dealt with season one, which was very dark. We've kind of dealt with all Burnham's, a lot of the family relationship stuff that was very complex in season two, and we can push that back. We're going to obviously have the mother probably in some way in season three, but I'm hoping to see more of these characters.
By that, do you mean Laurel?
Call me mother.
Oh, I can only hope. That is a bummer, though, when you leave season two behind, is knowing some of these great characters aren't going to be revisited.
Yeah, too bad, Ash Tyler.
Well, we still haven't dealt with the ramifications of the Klingons realizing Ash Tyler's alive. But
which is very bizarre, because it's such a big deal with his head being pulled out of that crate with the, for some reason, a baby's head. I don't know. I understand creators. Just because you can do it doesn't mean you should.
Right. But yeah, like a lot of the last season two, is a lot of the characters looking backwards at like their past relationships and things like that. I want to see season three, them looking forwards. Yeah. And the people we've seen them grow into up until this point, how do they tackle these problems that are something far beyond their comprehension in many ways? That is going to be exciting to me. And I just hope they're writing amazingly fun lines for them to say, because it looked like they were really on that track big time in season two, and I can't wait to see them expand on it.
Yep. Saru in the future, hanging out with his fellow Varahides Kelpians, shooting spikes at each other. That's going to be the episode I'm looking forward to most.
And singing. Don't forget
and
singing.
And singing funeral hymnals.
Well, hopefully not any funeral hymns. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next time?
We are going to be wrapping up Enterprise, our rewatches of the two-parters quite soon, Cam, because we have Affliction and Divergence, that Klingon virus episode coming up next. Speaking of retconning after this Star Trek Discovery talk that we just had now, we get to do a little bit more. This is a weird episode, but if you're into Star Trek lore, tune in. I think we're going to have a lot of fun with J.G. Hertzler making a return to Star Trek.
Correction, though, Tyler. Lore's not in this one.
Damn.
And, of course, you can find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vrahi Neck Needles Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N. N as in Neck Needles was mine, Cam.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.